Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we spoke with Neil D. Gross, MD, FACS. Dr. Gross is the Medical Director of Perioperative Surgical Services, Section Chief of Oropharynx Cancer Surgery, and Professor of Head and Neck Surgery at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Gross discussed the key biological and clinical distinctions between cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma and basal cell carcinoma, noting that although BCC is more indolent and less responsive to systemic therapies, including immunotherapy, CSCC carries a meaningful risk of nodal and distant metastases and has demonstrated robust responses to anti-PD-1 therapy, with approximately half of patients achieving a significant response. From a biological and clinical standpoint, how do you frame the key differences between cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma and basal cell carcinoma in terms of metastatic potential, immune responsiveness, and implications for systemic therapy selection?
You know, non-melanoma skin cancers are ubiquitous. If you put those together, it dwarfs all other solid tumors combined. And the most common of non-melanoma skin cancers are basal cell cancers, fortunately. Because those tend to be more indolent tumors, slower growing, far less likely to become metastatic. On the flip side, they're also far less responsive to treatments other than surgery. So less responsive to radiation, for example, less responsive to systemic therapies, and that includes immunotherapy. Standard of care for advanced unresectable or metastatic basal cell cancer remains a hedgehog inhibitors. So immunotherapy is the second line treatment. And, you know, the reason for that is that the responses are relatively muted for that disease. And in contrast, you know, for cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, these tumors do have a propensity for lymph node metastasis. So regional metastasis, distant metastasis, they can also develop significant perineural involvement, sometimes even without significant other disease. These tumors are life-threatening, and particularly in immunosuppressed patients, can be really, really challenging. Fortunately for these patients, immunotherapy has become the standard of care for patients with unresectable or metastatic disease. And that's because the responses are really quite remarkable. You know, about a half of patients will have a significant response to treatment. So it's really opened a door in that disease.
And with respect to patients with CSCC, what clinical or pathological features most strongly predict nodal involvement? And how does the presence of nodal versus non-nodal disease alter your staging workup and ultimate multidisciplinary management?
So I mentioned before that, you know, these patients, advanced cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma patients, can develop nodal metastasis. There's also a separate group of patients that seem to behave biologically very different. So instead of nodal metastasis, they can have very advanced local disease without regional or distant metastasis. And there's also a group that can have significant perineural disease, again, without regional or distant metastasis, and still be advanced stage. So, you know, very, very different presentations of disease. And that's one of the reasons I think there's been sort of a paucity of research in this space. It's just heterogeneous presentation of cancers. And that's, you know, why it's not included, for example, in the National Cancer Database or the SEER databases. And it's really been a blind spot for industry, I think, for a long time. So these patients, as common as the disease is, have been relatively underserved, and in particular, the patients who present with advanced disease. Now, Why is that? It's because there's so many skin cancers to start. It's ubiquitous, as I mentioned before, and it's only a fraction of those that will develop into lymph node metastasis or significant perineural disease. How do we predict which ones those will be? Obviously, larger tumors are more likely to become metastatic. Locally advanced or recurrent tumors. I mentioned before the immune suppressed population. This patient population is very, very high risk for recurrent disease, metastatic disease, and even dying of disease. perineural spread or lymphovascular invasion. These are significant predictors of either of recurrence and or metastasis as well. So, kind of a long-winded answer to your question, but we do have clues about which patients are going to be at highest risk to have recurrence, metastatic disease, or significant perineural spread.
So then, with the expanding role of immunotherapy, particularly cemiplimab and pembrolizumab, how are you identifying which patients with locally advanced or metastatic disease are the best candidates for those therapies? Even within the class, how are you distinguishing whether cemiplimab or pembrolizumab is the best option?
So it's great that we now have, tools that we can apply to these patients with advanced or unresectable disease. It's really important that they are seen in a multidisciplinary fashion to help figure out the right treatment for patients. I'm a surgeon. I believe strongly that these patients should get a surgical opinion early because one of the first branch points is to sort out if they're resectable or not. Because if they're unresectable or metastatic, then it's clear. For cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, it's now FDA approved for these patients to receive anti-PD-1 therapy as first-line treatment, and the responses are actually excellent. There are patients who are borderline resectable. So maybe surgery is possible, but the functional implication of surgery could leave patients with significant morbidity. You can think of a tumor, for example, encroaching on the eye and then surgery requiring orbital exoneration. That's life-altering functional loss. These patients, too, we would treat with upfront systemic therapy with anti-PD-1 therapy, right? Give them a chance to preserve the function because if they respond, and we've shown this in a phase two setting, then they can preserve function and be cured of disease at the same time. So that's for patients with borderline resectable disease. For patients with resectable cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, you can think patient with the locally advanced tumor on the scalp, for example, or lymph node metastasis to the parotid or neck. This is kind of the vast majority of patients that we see. Then the standard of care for those patients is upfront surgery still. Many of these patients after surgery would require radiation if it's advanced stage. And some of these patients, based on new data that was published just last year, the CPOS trial, some of these patients would be candidates for adjuvant cemiplimab as well. And specifically, these would be patients who have external spread, name, nerve involvement, in-transit disease. So it really depends on one, resectability, if they're resectable upfront, as sort of an early branch point. And I'll add that, we now have a trial that's open and accruing for patients specifically in this space. So patients with advanced resectable cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, these patients are eligible for NRG HN14. This trial is NCI sponsored. It's a cooperative group trial through NRG. It's open in the US, broadly in the US, Canada, and Australia, and it's accruing very well. And this is the test, the neoadjuvant approach versus the standard of care that I mentioned before, which is upfront surgery.
And then for patients who do ultimately get systemic therapy, particularly those who are elderly or immunocompromised, Are there specific considerations or modifications that should be made to the use of these agents when it comes to toxicity management?
Yeah, in general, anti-PD-1 therapies are very well tolerated in patients, even elderly patients, and that's been to the betterment of the community at large. But it's not perfectly safe, and there are patients that can have significant toxicities and even grade 4, grade 5 deaths with immunotherapy. There are some folks who have said to me, well, why even do a randomized phase 3 trial? Why even test the neoadjuvant approach? We should give neoadjuvant immunotherapy to everybody with advanced cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. And the answer to that is, well, we don't know it's safe. We honestly don't know that it's safe yet to do that. And that's the reason for a neoadjuvant approach. Not only do we not know it's safe, we don't know if it's any better than the current standard of care in terms of survival. There are toxicities. It's one potential benefit of a neoadjuvant approach with a short neoadjuvant window is that their exposure is less. We have shown that a neoadjuvant approach that you see responses pretty quick. And on the flip side, some of the toxicities can be delayed. And so careful monitoring of patients, any patient who's getting immunotherapy, whether it's neoadjuvant, which is still on experimental, it's in trial, or adjuvant, which is FDA approved for high-risk patients. In both cases, patients require monitoring.
And then lastly, looking at recent and upcoming medical meetings, congresses, what developments do you think will most significantly shift the treatment paradigm for cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma over the next few years, particularly in the adjuvant or neoadjuvant settings? I know you already mentioned the NRG trial, but if there's any others.
Well, the CPOS trial, this is the trial that led to the FDA indication for adjuvant cemiplimab. That was based on an interim analysis. So I'm sure we'll be seeing more mature data from that trial. And I think everyone will be looking to see how overall survival looks long term in patients in that study. They didn't meet a difference in overall survival between the treatment arms in that, but perhaps it was early, and also there was crossover allowed in the trial. So that'll be, I think, coming up. We are planning to present the phase 2 data from the single arm neoadjuvant trial. This is the trial that was the basis for the current randomized trial. So that phase 2 data long term will be presented probably later this year. So we're looking forward to that. And then, there is a lot of interest in exploring what combination strategies can be applied to these patients safely. You mentioned that they're elderly and we worry about toxicity and tolerance of treatment. So combining dual agent immunotherapy, for example, there's exploration and that's further exploration in that space and really testing the safety of this approach. The combination of SBRT plus immunotherapy, for example, in patients who are borderline unresectable is also something that we hope to kind of see in the future. And then I mentioned before the immunosuppressed population is such a high-risk group of patients that is really very much underserved. And so we hope to see more data around these populations in particular.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.